Is Radio Equal Shot with your host, Alex Smith.
In the hottest times of human history, can we have industrial civilization and a livable climate? Can we make things like steel, cement, and chemicals without adding greenhouse gases? The products you buy and the way you live depend on getting the right answers. With two master's degrees in the environment, engineering, and planning, Jeffrey Rissman is Senior Director for Industry at the American nonprofit called Energy Innovation. Following earlier books and guides, Rissman fully lays out future viable technologies in his upcoming book, Zero Carbon Industry, Transformative Technologies and Policies to Achieve Sustainable Prosperity. Is it real? Can it happen? From Energy Innovation, Jeffrey Rissman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, this is a huge new book published by Columbia University Press. It covers almost every pathway to net zero production. We couldn't cover it in 20 interviews. So let's start with a couple of basics our listeners use every day, steel and cement. And I want to begin with a headline familiar to our UK listeners. The Indian-owned conglomerate Tata is closing a coal-fired steel mill in the south of Wales, and Port Talbot's been a mill town for generations, and now they're going to lose 3,000 decently paid jobs. The UK Conservative government is funding that change from coal power to electric arc furnaces with £500 million of taxpayers' money in a four-year conversion. It will cut the UK's overall greenhouse gas emissions about 1.5%. Jeffrey, where do you see this move by Tata in the larger story of steel production without fossil fuels?
The steel industry is starting to undergo a transformation to adopt cleaner processes. Now, there's electric arc furnaces you mentioned, which are today used to recycle steel, scrap steel, to make new steel. But there's also new ways to create primary steel from iron ore without greenhouse gases. For example, using clean hydrogen as a way to convert the ore into metallic iron instead of coal.
But we don't have enough clean hydrogen at the moment, and as I understand it, natural gas is still needed for part of this electric arc furnace.
So scaling up clean hydrogen will be important for decarbonizing the primary steel industry. To some degree, you know, the electric arc furnaces, you can use more recycled or scrap steel, but ultimately we don't have enough scrap to recycle to meet the demand for steel. So we will need to grow the availability of clean hydrogen, which is made from zero carbon electricity sources like solar and wind. For the last few decades, electric arc furnaces that have been installed tend to have natural gas burners around their edges. That's in order to heat the metal more uniformly throughout the furnace, but they're not strictly necessary. There were electric arc furnaces built without the natural gas burners, and there are other technologies that can be used to heat the edges, like induction, electromagnetic induction, where similar to an induction furnace, another technology I discuss in my book. Even with the burners, it still emits only about 7% as much greenhouse gases as making new primary steel in a coal-fired blast furnace. So there's a large emissions reduction right there, even before you switch off the natural gas burners.
Can you tell us about innovations in Sweden and Germany that could enable steel production in a net zero world?
Sweden has a new pioneering effort called Hybrit, where a consortium of several companies has developed technology to make new primary steel from clean hydrogen. The process is called hydrogen direct reduced iron. Reduction here means taking iron ore, which is a mineral from the ground, iron oxides, and removing the oxygen atoms, which leaves behind metallic iron. Metallic iron is the main component of steel. Steel is mostly iron with a little bit of carbon added for strength. In Germany, there are companies that are working on scaling up this technology and have announced plans to deploy and convert over some of their existing sites and facilities that may be using blast furnaces today to this hydrogen direct reduced iron process. And that could be accompanied by efforts to expand access to clean hydrogen for example, Germany's Clean Hydrogen Coastline Project.
Well, there are other approaches. I was wondering, steelmaking maybe should follow the aluminum industry to build plants near large renewable resources. Examples include the Kitimat Aluminum Plant, Kitimat Aluminum Plant in British Columbia, powered by hydroelectricity, or plants in Iceland using combined hydro and geothermal energy. Maybe Tata and other steelmakers should move to Iceland instead. Or would the greenhouse gases savings be lost to longer shipping routes to the manufacturers?
No, the greenhouse gas savings would not be lost due to the shipping. It does make sense to potentially locate where there's an abundance of clean electricity, because the electricity, clean electricity, is the main thing you need to produce the electrolytic or green hydrogen, which is about two-thirds of the energy involved in making steel through this process. The remaining third is in the electric arc furnace that transforms the direct reduced iron into steel. And that uses electricity as well. So all of it is based on electricity. And so it can often be difficult to build new transmission lines to bring electricity long distances due to permitting challenges. And so it can be very sensible to do what you suggested and potentially locate facilities where clean electricity is abundant and lower cost.
Well, here's a problem seldom discussed. A lot of steel products were replaced with plastics. Just look around your car or your home. Almost everything we buy has some plastic in it. But plastic is made from coal, gas, or oil, and we can't cut emissions without reducing plastic production, not to mention the tidal wave of plastic particles everywhere on Earth. Can we get out of this plastic trap, Jeff?
It's a great question, and I think there are two approaches. There's the material efficiency and circular economy, which attempts to reduce our dependence on plastics. And then there are approaches to produce the plastic that we do need more cleanly. And they're both important. Material efficiency measures can essentially say what we care about is the ultimate service or purpose that a good is delivering. So for plastic packaging, say, all we care about is that the product inside the packaging reaches us intact and in working order. We don't need excess packaging beyond that. There are also material substitution alternatives. For instance, you can potentially package something in a cardboard box with, you know, paper filling instead of in plastic. There are opportunities there to cut plastic use that don't make the experience of using the product any worse. In some cases, avoiding excess material use and waste can be better. That can lower our plastic demand, but we're unlikely to completely eliminate all uses of plastics. The remaining plastics that we do expect to still produce, you can make using clean materials. So the materials that go into making chemicals and chemical products like plastics are called feedstocks, the coal and natural gas and petroleum that you just mentioned. But you can make the same petrochemicals out of clean materials, whether that's bioenergy or hydrogen paired with captured carbon. And this is actually one of the higher value uses of hydrogen. If you use it for steel and for plastics, these are uses where you can't directly electrify it because you need the material. Whereas if you just need heat, industrial heat, you might as well use electricity directly and not waste any green hydrogen that you've made. Once you've made the petrochemicals, they would no longer be petrochemicals, I suppose, if made from clean sources. Then the process of turning those into plastics remains the same as today, except you could power the heat with electricity.
Your new book, Zero Carbon Industry, Transformative Technologies, next tackles the most human-made material. Concrete has become something of a mania with humans. We're encasing all our rivers and our homes and everything. Who are the biggest cement makers, and is the industry a significant contributor to greenhouse gases?
Cement is an enormous contributor. It's one of the top three emitting industries, along with iron and steel and chemicals. And the biggest contributor is China, because they create a lot of concrete as a building material for their infrastructure, bridges, buildings, and so on. Concrete is a composite material where cement, which is a binder like glue, is mixed with crushed rocks and stone called aggregate. And it's really the cement component that has high greenhouse gas emissions, because crushing rock doesn't require much energy, and you can use electricity to do it. But cement. To make cement, you have to take limestone or calcium carbonate and heat it in a cement kiln, which breaks down that calcium carbonate, and that process releases CO2. And that's additional to any CO2 from the fuels you burn, which is usually coal today, to heat the cement kiln. So the process of decarbonizing cement actually involves two steps or two parts. One is to use zero carbon heat. You can use electricity to heat a cement kiln or a precalciner, which is the step before the materials go into the kiln and begins heating them up. And then you need a way to address the emissions from breaking down the limestone rock. There are approaches to do that. There are low-carbon cement chemistries that, and potentially even zero-carbon magnesium-based options that don't emit CO2 when broken down. You could use carbon capture to capture the CO2 emitted from the limestone and store it underground. And, of course, there are efficiency measures. You can use less cement, either by using fillers or being more judicious in how you place concrete. For example, you can use curved fabric molds to place concrete only where you need it for structural integrity and avoid wasting excess concrete.
But then strangely, and I did not know this, aging cement begins to absorb carbon dioxide from the air, becoming helpful to slow climate change. Is carbon absorption by concrete significant, and is it enough to compensate for all the emissions from making cement?
Carbon absorption by cement in concrete, once it's in service in a building, is very significant on a global scale. I believe it offset 1 or 2% of global CO2 emissions in recent years, which is huge. But it is not enough to offset the emissions from making the cement. When the cement is put into service and hardens and then it slowly absorbs CO2, it will eventually absorb about half as much CO2 as it emitted from its process emissions, meaning from the breakdown of limestone. So even if you used electricity to heat the cement kiln, if you didn't do anything about the CO2 from limestone, it would still emit twice as much CO2 as it ultimately absorbs. But if you could capture that CO2, suppose you used electrical heating for the cement kiln, and then you captured the limestone CO2 and stored it, then the cement would go on to sequester CO2 from the atmosphere, about half as much as it emitted. But since what it emitted was stored underground, it could be a way to reduce atmospheric CO2 concentrations.
Well, you mentioned carbon capture, and it's very controversial because, in all its scenarios, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change depends entirely on massive recapture of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We might go above 2 degrees global warming average, but then bring it back down with carbon capture. Earlier attempts at this were tiny, and they've been abandoned, some of them. Climate scientists like Kevin Anderson call it a unicorn, basically a fairy tale leading us to burn more fossil fuels. Jeff, you write with some pretty hard-eyed optimism in technology. Do you really believe carbon capture, in a big scale, will happen enough to claw back the temperatures we need?
So there are two approaches to carbon capture. There's direct air capture, which is what you're talking about, reduce taking carbon out of the atmosphere. And then there's capture at an industrial facility from a smokestack or from a cement kiln. I do not think we should be relying on direct air capture. I think it's very expensive and very energy intensive because CO2 is at a low concentration in the atmosphere relative to other components like nitrogen and oxygen. So it requires a lot of energy, and it's much more technologically feasible and cost effective to avoid having those emissions enter the atmosphere in the first place. So I am not a fan of the direct air capture form of carbon capture. For the type that's done in an industrial facility, I think there are limited cases where it can make sense. Cement making is one of them because the emissions from limestone breakdown are not from fossil fuels. So even if we displaced the fossil fuels, we still would have some CO2 from this calcium carbonate rock. And there are limited ways to address it without carbon capture. You can reduce the use of cement. You can some of these new chemistries can reduce the amount of CO2 per unit of cement. It's hard to get rid of it entirely. without some carbon capture in cement kilns. This is a fairly narrow niche, though, and I would caution against overuse of carbon capture when more effective tools are available. One thing to keep in mind is that if you're trying to burn fossil fuels and use carbon capture, even if the carbon capture works, you still have emissions from the upstream production and processing of the fossil fuels, such as the drilling for oil and gas and natural gas processing or oil refining. So the carbon capture at the facility isn't addressing upstream emissions like that. In the case for fossil fuels, there may be some narrow niches for it, but its best fit is with cement kilns and limestone.
My reading of your book suggests profit-oriented industry alone cannot solve the climate crisis. We need major policy changes by governments with public support and participation. In the 1990s, the big answer was cap and trade, a kind of inter-industry carbon emissions trading system overseen by governments. These schemes had pretty limited success, so what do you think?
I think policy is extremely important, as you suggested, for achieving a clean industrial future. And no single policy is a silver bullet. So I think that cap and trade has its place. It's a form of carbon pricing, carbon tax being the other. And there are numerous jurisdictions around the world today that use cap and trade and use carbon pricing as a policy tool. Europe has the European Emissions Trading System. California has a cap and trade system. There's the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the eastern U.S. And elsewhere. The right policy depends on the maturity of the technology. Cap and trade and carbon pricing in general is best for when a clean alternative is fairly well developed. And so the price incentive is enough to switch the choice. You know, an industrial facility manager will choose to use the clean technology instead of the dirty technology in order to avoid paying that carbon price. At an earlier technological stage, if the clean option isn't readily available, then their only option is to pay the carbon price and to continue to emit carbon, which is not ultimately the goal. The goal is to stop the emissions, not to have them pay the fee. So I think it's a very useful policy in some situations and has been used successfully, but is not the only policy we need, not nearly.
Jeff, talk to us about green banks and why we need them.
Green banks are a great example of another important and useful approach to helping scale up clean industry. A green bank is an organization often affiliated with a government or first funded by a government, though it may become independent or be quasi-independent. They have a pool of money, and they use it to try to leverage to try to make financing available to industries that want to implement clean processes and clean equipment. So there's some upfront cost to buying new equipment and installing it, and it may be difficult, especially for an industry that's trying a new clean approach, to get affordable financing in the private market. So a green bank can use a number of tools to help make this financing more available. They can partner with a private lender and each lend some money, called co-lending. They could use loan loss reserves or loan guarantees, which says to the private lender, you lend the money. If they don't pay it back, we'll cover some or all of the loss. And that lessens the risk for the private lenders, so they're willing to offer a low interest rate on the loan. Or they can issue bonds. So because they are often affiliated with governments, they can issue government bonds, which may have special tax treatment. They may be tax exempt from certain types of income tax, and use these bonds to help fund clean industry. Essentially, they're an organization that uses this range of tools to make cheap financing available for clean industry.
Can governments lead the way with their own purchasing? And tell us how the Netherlands approached green public procurement.
Governments absolutely can lead the way. Governments are major buyers of industrial products like steel and cement and concrete because they fund infrastructure like roads and bridges and public buildings like public offices and schools. And government can decide what they want to purchase with their own money. So one approach is to leverage this ability of government to decide what to purchase and set aside a share of the government budget for zero carbon or low carbon industrial products, especially construction materials like steel and cement. So the government might say 5% initially of our steel has to be primary steel from a new hydrogen-based or other zero-carbon process. And then a steelmaker will see that there is a guaranteed market if they install a new hydrogen-direct-reduced iron furnace system, they will have a buyer for that steel. And government can promise that for the next 20 years or whatever, they will buy at least so much. And that gives them the steelmaker the confidence they need to invest in the new clean technology. As they invest and scale it up, the price will come down and availability can go up, and then government can ratchet up its purchases. Maybe then, you know, several years later, they'll be buying 10% of their steel as clean steel and then 20%. And as prices go down, it will enter the private market and private buyers who want clean steel, say an automaker who wants to make clean vehicles, will start purchasing it. So it's a way to create a starter market that helps this technology scale and achieve these cost benefits. You mentioned the Netherlands. They're a country with a strong public procurement process, including support and tools. I believe they even have software that helps companies assess the life cycle carbon emissions from their products and understand how the government is measuring it so that they can improve their processes in ways that lower life cycle carbon emissions and help them qualify to be purchased by government agencies.
Well, speaking of software, Jeffrey Reisman, you also created a tool called the Energy Policy Simulator. What does it do, and are people using it?
So before writing this book, I created a piece of open source free software, the Energy Policy Simulator. It's a computer model that lets you or anyone be the role of a policymaker. So it has dozens, more than 100 different policy levers that you can set across every part of the economy. That could be carbon pricing, it can be efficiency standards, it can be all the things we've been talking about and more. And not just industry. When I say across the economy, I mean in the transport sector, in buildings, in electric power generation. So it has things like a renewable portfolio standard for power plants. And then it will calculate what these policies will do and give outputs that are useful to policymakers. How much will it cut emissions? How many jobs will the investment create and how will it contribute to the economy? How many lives will it save because of reduced conventional pollutant emissions? Because it also tracks emissions not just of greenhouse gases, but of particulates and other pollutants that cause heart attacks and lung disease, so it can estimate reductions in deaths from those pollutants. It's available for anyone to use at energypolicy.solutions online, and it's been used in a growing number of countries and subnational regions like U.S. states or Canadian provinces to help policymakers understand what policy would really move the needle, what would cut emissions and achieve their goals, and what would the co-benefits be in terms of public health and jobs and so on.
One thing I would like to see in your book is a little bit more urgency, maybe rating these tools for the time that it takes to implement them. I mean, if we're building towards net zero for 2045 or 2050, that may be too late if we pass certain tipping points by 2030 on our current rate. So are you thinking about tools that can work fast so that we don't get Miami and New York flooded?
It is important to address the climate crisis quickly, because it is urgent. Fortunately, there are some technologies that are commercialized and ready to go and could be deployed today if we get the right incentives in place. A good example would be industrial heat pumps. They're similar to an air conditioner or a refrigerator or even a heat pump you might have in your home that moves heat from one place to another using electricity, and it can be clean electricity. This technology exists. There are companies that make and sell industrial heat pumps today, and there is no more efficient way to create industrial heat up to about 165 degrees Celsius, which is enough to meet about a third of industrial heat demand. So policies that could get these deployed today are important. These could include incentives, financial incentives. They could include electricity rates that are amenable to industrial electrification and the green banks that we discussed before, as well as potentially energy efficiency standards, since heat pumps are so efficient that as long as your standard is written to be technology neutral, fuel neutral, electric technologies in general, and heat pumps in particular, will be one of the easiest ways to comply.
Well, your work reminds me of Professor Mark Jacobson of MIT. Jacobson joins a chorus of experts and CEOs who say we have the technology for a low-carbon civilization if we can find the will to do it. Your book title promises us sustainable prosperity. Given all the challenges, not just climate, but wars and pandemic and AI and crime, I'm doubtful. Jeffrey, where does your optimism come from?
I don't want to minimize any of these challenges you've mentioned, and none of this will happen on its own. It requires dedicated people who care about transitioning to a clean energy future, who care about the future of the climate and human society and ecosystems and the rest that benefit from a livable climate. That includes the policymakers that are needed to enact policies to get these technologies in place. It includes the scientists and engineers who are developing them and driving down costs. It includes journalists and radio hosts like yourself who are helping to get the word out about how urgent and important all of this is. There is an optimism that I have, which is that I see people are working on it from all of these angles. And I believe that it is possible. It doesn't mean that it's going to be easy, and I would encourage listeners to think about how they can contribute, whether that is going into one of these fields, becoming an engineer working on solar or wind or clean industrial equipment, or a journalist or the like, or trying to move the needle on policy, because it will be a large group effort to get this done, but I do believe it's possible.
From Energy Innovation, we have been speaking with Senior Director for Industry, Jeffrey Reisman. His new book, coming out in February, is Zero Carbon Industry, Transformative Technologies and Policies to Achieve Sustainable Prosperity. You can download this interview or pass it on with links in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Jeff, thank you for digging into all this and telling us about it.
Thank you, Alex. I really appreciate the chance to share.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Last week, we discovered even more climate-wrecking emissions as methane, the so-called natural gas. Well, its burning hit absolute record highs. U.S. fracking production is overflowing into multiple giant liquefied natural gas ports, and they're in Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Their plans and investments stretch decades into our damaged future. Then I warned, don't forget about oil. Everything runs on oil and oil byproducts, from transportation through trillions of tons of plastics, cosmetics, clothes, everything. According to the International Energy Agency, total world demand for oil rose 2.3 million barrels a day, every single day. They project global demand for oil by 2050 to be a third higher than that. Who are the oil giants poisoning the atmosphere? You want to say Saudi Arabia, but they are only the third largest oil producer. Russia is number two. America is the single largest producer of oil, the pollution from burning it, the leftover toxins, the end of the climate we evolved in. America is number one. This oil and gas energy boom sounds great for everyone. I hope this year's heat and wild weather swings don't kill off my fruit trees. With hardly any snow this mild winter, we expect a hot, dry summer, maybe another record year for wildfires here in the West. I hope our house doesn't burn down. I hope the bees and the bugs can make it for another year. I hope humans come to their senses and end this fossil-fueled bitter end party. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.